John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, I think we should change the name of this show to The Interview. I hear that name is available. The Interview. The interviews, plural. We do that every day on this program. And Kim Jong-un, if you're out there, if you want to come on The Takeaway, you can be assured of your physical safety and tougher questions than you'd get from James Franco on this program. So keep that in mind in Pyongyang. But let's start today's hour with a real question. Is terrorism now a form of comedy? What an odd note to end the week on, except this week has been all about defining what terrorism actually is. The U.S. has to decide if Cuba, for instance, is really a terrorist nation now. It's still on Washington's old axis of evil terror list. Pakistan has to decide if terrorism in India is somehow morally tolerable compared to the violence that killed more than 100 school children in Peshawar this week. No laughs there. And we'll have a serious conversation about that with the former ambassador from Pakistan to the UK. But Seth Rogen, fighter for freedom in North Korea, Rogen and James Franco's movie, directed by Rogen and Evan Goldberg, The Interview, has been described as a risky comedy challenging audiences to think about world affairs. Others have said it's just a cheap shot against a crackpot dictator nobody takes seriously, except perhaps the 25 million people being ruled and often starved under the Pyongyang regime. The Interview was targeted by cyber terrorists, as we know now. That was first funny because it allowed us to giggle about the weirdnesses of Sony executives in their leaked private emails. Then it was no joke. Threats of violence if people went to see this tale about a wacky assassination plot against the leader of North Korea. Then no movie. Sony pulled the plug. Stars outraged. A Japanese giant hobbled by threats reportedly from North Korea. And now the Obama administration says North Korea is indeed behind this attack. And a big Hollywood reveal of just how vulnerable the world might be to this plot line. Is this the new terrorism? Joining us is Thomas Hubbard. He served as U.S. ambassador to South Korea from 2001 to 2004. He's now the chairman of the Korea Society. Thomas Hubbard, welcome.
Hello. How are you, John?
This is good to be with you. I'm great. And this is a remarkable story to think about the issues between North and South Korea and North Korea and the rest of the world. As a diplomat, can you imagine being in a meeting where you'd have to say it is the position of the United States that Seth Rogen's political views are his own and we take no position on them, da-da-da-da-da? I mean, in some sense, a comedy has become an international diplomatic incident.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Something that began as almost a joke has turned into a very serious matter in which a major corporation has been seriously damaged. A movie has been stopped from being actually shown around the country. And I think very importantly, we've had what amounts to a terrorist threat. That is, that whoever is behind this, and most assumptions seem to point at North Korea, had actually threatened viewers who might have gone to the movie with physical damage, with an allusion to 9/11. So what began really as a joke has become something very serious, not funny at all.
And I suspect as a diplomat, you spent plenty of time talking about piracy in Asia and how the export of American movies is a huge sort of cultural stamp of the United States on the entire global economy. I'm wondering if, looking at all of that now, it seems as though our export of movies is also a huge vulnerability in the sense that we are at play in the movies that we release politically and the messages that come from those movies.
Well, in a way, we are facing a new world in which a small country like North Korea, with a fairly high technological capability, is able to threaten real harm to an American, major American economic and cultural interest, and actually threaten harm to people. So, I've been to North Korea twice. I've had conversations with North Koreans that are not all that different from what you just said. And let me say, North Korea is no joke. It is a country that poses a number of serious threats. It has carried out several nuclear explosions. It has, with a partial success, launched multi-stage intercontinental ballistic missiles. It has repressed its own people in very serious ways, and now it's shown this this capability apparently with cyber technology that does create a new world.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because you mentioned the nuclear approach that North Korea took. It bought off-the-shelf technology from Pakistan, an AQ-Con. It was in the AQ-Con network. I'm wondering if North Korea may have just purchased the hack here, basically contacted someone in the West or even in Japan to carry this out, and that would very much be their MO, based on your experience.
That could be quite true. Somehow they seem to have gotten sort of an initial edge into the computer system. I'm not not an expert in these things myself, but it could be they bought or stole their way into that.
And, you know, the other thing that's pretty disturbing about this from the perspective of a journalist, I would think, or a diplomat, I would think, and journalists for that matter, since journalists were pilloried in this movie, is how this bypasses the nation state. I mean, this is an international terrorist incident, one nation against a corporation, but in a nation that has already been targeted by terrorists, the United States. Japan has a unique relationship with Korea. I'm wondering if the fact that Sony did this as a multinational corporation quickly, before there was any ability of diplomats to basically intercede here and try to maybe work this out in some other way, does that herald a new world in the sense that you're going to have corporations dealing with countries, and that, you know, the United Nations and the sort of traditional governance institutions in diplomacy are just out of the picture here, out of the loop?
Well, that's right. And this, of course, affects a number of countries, not only the United States, but Japan, which has been engaged with North Korea in trying to resolve some of the longstanding problems they have. It affects South Korea. It's one of the, I think, issues in going forward and trying to find out how to respond, what to do about this, is that it is going to require international cooperation in going forward. I think we have to be very sure we have the facts, that we're clear on what has happened, and we have to consult very closely with friends and allies like Japan and South Korea, as well as with other countries like China and Russia, who also have connections with North Korea.
But considering how rapidly this iterated itself into a global incident, it will take some redesigning of diplomacy to get into that pace of development, that's for sure. Thomas Hubbard, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thomas Hubbard served as U.S. ambassador to South Korea from 2001 to 2004. He's now the chairman of the Korea Society. This has been an important week to consider what constitutes terrorism in the nation of Pakistan. While the nation has seemed more or less united in outrage over the attack on the Peshawar school on Monday, there has been considerable soul-searching within Pakistan over whether terrorist groups are tolerated by certain politically powerful factions inside Pakistan. And certainly, that question is raised once again as a Pakistani court granted bail to a senior commander with Lashkar-e-Taiba, Zakir Rahman Lakhvi. Lakhvi was released on a bond of about $5,000, even though he is considered to be, and accused of being, in fact, behind the Mumbai terror attack, a four-day violent siege on India's most populous city that left 164 people dead and more than 300 wounded 6 years ago. Prosecutors in Pakistan are appealing the grant of bail, and up until now, Lakhvi remains in a high-security prison in Rawalpindi. Akbar Ahmed is chair of the Islamic Studies Department at American University and Pakistan's former ambassador to the United Kingdom. He's also the author of The Thistle and the Drone, How America's War on Terror Became a Global War on Tribal Islam. Akbar Ahmed, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you, John. Great to be back.
So how upsetting is this to people within India and even within Pakistan that this grant of bail should take place?
It is very upsetting. In India, the reaction has been predictably anger, surprise, the feeling that Pakistan can't be trusted, that this man who is so blatantly involved in one of these terrible, terrible crimes in Mumbai has been sitting in jail. The case is still dragging, and then five, six years later, he gets bail. At the same time, in Pakistan, my sense is, John, that people are in such a state of shock right now. And we need not connect the two things, the massacre in Peshawar, which killed almost 150 people, including so many children, and this particular bail, because the bail was given by an anti-terrorist court. These have been set up specifically to deal with terrorist cases, and they take their own sweet time. They're quite independent, so it's very difficult for government to intervene. Now, the reaction of the government of Pakistan is interesting because they are now appealing against the decision of this particular court. That's number one. And number two, there is a mood now after the Peshawar's massacre in Pakistan to deal firmly and unequivocally with the terrorists. So I think the mood has changed very much and would affect a case like Mr. Zakirullah's case.
Well, if the appeal is successful and he goes back into prison, and if what you're saying is correct, that there is a greater clarity in Pakistan, it would certainly strike at something that has been very, very difficult for Pakistan really for the last two decades, and that is understanding a sense of consistency regarding terrorism. There are so many threats surrounding Pakistan and within Pakistan that it's always seemed to me that there's been a different way of judging terrorism inside India, terrorism that's involved in Afghanistan, terrorism that strikes within Pakistan. There's all these nuanced different kinds of groups, Lashkar-e-Taiba, Taliban Afghanistan, Taliban Pakistan. And you're saying that this may be a sea change and that there will be a much clearer sense that terrorism is over the line regardless of the ideology of the group.
Yes, because, John, you use the word nuance. We have to understand that Pakistan is partly a tribal society. A lot of the tribes live on both sides of the border, Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's also a very sophisticated urban society. It's also an agricultural society. And all these different societies mesh and overlap and are juxtaposed. And within that, you'll have people who would be horrified by any acts of terror. Then you'll have people who'll say, well, the people involved were tribal, they were cousins, so we need to be lenient or look the other way. That is why you see this inconsistency of policy. But what this strike in Peshawar has done has literally shaken the nation. And the mood now is grim. And I hope there is now a consistency in terms of policy and, more important, in terms of a method to deal with this kind of terrorism. Now, I'm hearing the new commander-in-chief, for example, actually talking about hanging or executing the terrorists who are already in captivity. I'm hearing senior generals saying, shoot all 20,000 of the captives in jail and so on. So this is the kind of emotion you're seeing, which did not exist last week, for example. Even the prime minister said that I'm going to now deal with them very, very sternly. Now, for him also, this is a change because his party, the Muslim League, tended to be or was seen to be softer on the Taliban than other parties. So these are indications that Pakistan is going to now start taking this threat very seriously and recognize that it's not all about the United States, that this is a problem that is Pakistan's problem and it must be solved. It cannot go on like this, or the state itself is in danger of unraveling.
Well, that's really the question for the rest of the world observing Pakistan. Is this a fork in the road? Will it change a sense of inconsistency regarding terrorism? Or will it perpetuate a sense of tribal revenge? And part of the emotion that you describe here, we're going to get serious, we're going to shoot all 20,000, could actually continue a sense of tribal revenge that actually fuels the inconsistency if there isn't a sense of sort of civic order that's sort of brought in here to supersede that tribal emotion.
Well, John, my friend, you put your finger on it, because this, as you know, is the thesis of my book, that in fact, what you're seeing is very tribal. You have the Taliban, who are straight tribals, and you have the Pakistan Army involved as their main adversary in the field, who are not tribal. And you're seeing both act exactly as if they were involved in a tribal conflict. And the theme of revenge, attack, counterattack, revenge is very, very important. When this strike took place, I was in Copenhagen. The next morning, the Taliban issued a statement saying, this is in revenge for the operations in North Waziristan. Now, you're absolutely right. When that strike took place, the army acted in anger. They sent in the planes, they bombarded the tribal areas, they declared so many dozens killed. And you are now going to expect the Taliban to strike, and they will strike at a soft spot. This is dreadful because they're actually targeting children, women, mosques, churches. It's complete madness. But you cannot afford this constant cycle of violence. This has to stop, and the government has to have a reasoned, balanced, long-term policy to completely contain and then eradicate the problem.
Akbar Ahmed is chair of the Islamic Studies Department at American University and Pakistan's former ambassador to the United Kingdom, author of The Thistle and the Drone, How America's War on Terror Became a Global War on Tribal Islam. Akbar, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Cancer can either beat you or you beat it. I prefer the latter.
Is there a final score in the cancer battles of three African-American women who have invited us on their journey surviving breast cancer this year? Maybe not. Our six-month series, Under Her Skin, will come to an end with the end of 2014. And for Anita Coleman, December began with some good news.
It's December 3rd, 2014. This is the last day of radiation. I am truly thankful. I am truly blessed. I thank my medical team. They are extraordinary.
They could hardly be more exceptional than our good friend Anita, taking it day by day in the city of Los Angeles with laughs and setbacks. On December 10th, Anita underwent an elective surgery to remove her ovaries after testing positive for the BRCA gene, which puts her at a higher risk for ovarian cancer as well as breast cancer. But Anita told us she sees that surgery as one of the last big hurdles of this amazing year.
My current health challenge and the experiences that have accompanied it have provided me with a greater appreciation of life. What you see, the physical me you see when the hair was gone, the nails turned black, the swelling, that's not me. I am inside of me.
I still have one more surgery to have, and that surgery is a hysterectomy.
About a week ago, Lisa Eccles in Memphis celebrated 1 year from the day she was diagnosed. It's been quite a year of treatments, and she's not done yet.
That is something that I wanted to do, to be on the safe side. That was my plan in the beginning, so I will be getting that done right after the holidays.
A big to-do list for Lisa in 2014. 6 rounds of chemotherapy, a bilateral mastectomy, Herceptin treatment, reconstruction, implants. And Lisa now takes medication that she will remain on for years. She didn't expect to be this much in control at this point, though, and to feel this much support, something she got in part by deciding to share her story in our Under Her Skin community.
To be able to step out of my comfort zone and do something that I never had to do in my life, you know. I really, really like this experience to be able to talk to people and motivate people to keep pushing on and don't give up and just know that you're not in this by yourself and to let them know that it's going to be okay and that there is hope even when you are about to give up. Don't.
I feel like I can see the other side, you know? The storm's over and I can see the rainbow starting to form. I think that in itself is like a beautiful thing. I think it's the most important part of the story, the recovery.
Crystal Miller is also just a year out from her diagnosis, living and working in New York, and able to say the words that were so hard to imagine not long ago, cancer-free.
To me, this wasn't about breast cancer in itself. It was about me facing something that was out of my hands, that some things I didn't have control over, about finding my relationship with God, and I live by myself and live alone, so some things I don't talk about, or I really don't communicate it or write it down and just get it out there. And I think that helped with this, to really document what I was feeling at times and what I was going through, And I think it probably may have surprised people who were closer to me to know what I was feeling at times or what I was going through. I definitely had my moments, and I think that's okay. I think it was good to show that.
Instead of saying, I feel so sorry for myself, I have cancer, that they will say, I can beat this, and I will.
We can beat this. You can beat this, and you gonna beat this. Just fight on, sister, fight on.
They have already won in so many ways. If you want to respond to what you just heard, you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Join our Facebook group for this project. Just go to Facebook.com and type in Under Her Skin. For the end of our series, we'll gather Lisa, Crystal, and Anita all together for a final conversation about what it means to really live when you are living with breast cancer.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. I've been so blessed. It's 12 days long, so Merry Christmas from us at Good Time.
And just for the holidays, five. Not five internet things, but five. It's because we love Sean Ramaswamy, host of Sideshow, a Studio 360 podcast.
I wore a tie for this occasion, by the way. Did you notice?
I love it.
It does.
Beautiful.
It does this. It's the worst sound you've ever heard. But this is what we're tired of. This list of alternative Christmas music I brought you is the opposite of what my tie is doing right now. And it will stop.
It will stop.
There you
Thank
go.
You.
It
That's
stopped.
So you have a list of all kinds of alternative music that you're getting, and you
yes.
decided to choose the worst or the best. What
have
you given?
So my
best.
Argument here is that the industrial Christmas music complex is a lot like Christmas itself. You get like boring socks and sweaters, and this year's version of that is the new Earth, Wind & Fire Christmas album, which
Not
is like
good.
It's unlistenable. And then the worst of all might be the most offensive is Seth MacFarlane of Family Guy and American Dad released an album of like Christmas standards. And I don't know who told him that was a good idea, but it's awful. So to counteract
Thank
all
you.
Of that, I brought five selections here that you might actually find interesting and fun and want to listen to more than once.
So let's start with your first here.
What?
Okay, so a six-piece indie pop band from Cardiff, Wales called Los Campesinos released like Christmas EP this year. The first single is called When Christmas Comes.
When I go home, I will walk by your tinsel town down.
It takes a certain amount of courage to try to write a Christmas song that isn't a standard.
Especially when your fans are like the indie rock set, you know, because
yeah.
they're not going to like it.
Number two?
Number two, Mark Kozelik, who's this, you know, contemplative indie rocker with who's known for his like acoustic balladry, has spent most of the year getting in verbal altercations with people at his shows and other bands, and it's got a lot of pickup, actually, because no one expects that from him. But he's closing out the year with a mostly traditional album of Christmas music, and it's actually lovely.
Christmas time is here. Happiness and cheer. Fun for all that children call the favorite
cover, of course, of the famous Vince Guaraldi, Charlie Brown score. Number three.
Number three, have you ever wondered what Tchaikovsky's theme from The Nutcracker would sound like with a trap beat? Because I can make that happen for you right now, I think.
Okay, let's do it. And you think this is an improvement?
I do. It's a lot of fun. So this one's only online. This is a collection from Diplo and his Mad Decent Pals, who are known for their sort of like insanely thunderous take on electronic dance music.
But the cut itself is called...
It's by Davuti, and it's called The Nutcracker.
Nutcracker. Number four.
Number four, Liz Phair, the indie queen, has not released any music in a while, but she said she's always wanted to write a dystopian Christmas song, and she finally did this year.
All I wanted was one perfect Christmas. All I got was some coal and some switches. This is the dimmest house on the block. They're hanging stockings and we're hanging socks.
So that one's appropriately titled Ho Ho Ho.
Yeah. Number five.
The last one we have for you is The Killers featuring Jimmy Kimmel. They put out a song called Joel the Lump of Coal.
Some time ago at Santa's place up in the old North Pole, There lived a lump of anthracite whose parents called him Joe. Joe, Joe, the lump of coal, happy as a lump can be.
And if nothing else, it proves that, you know, it adds to the canon how well Joel can rhyme with Cole.
But Santa Claus had other plans for Joel one fateful day.
Joel, you're just the lump I need. Come join me on my sleigh.
I guess I'm down with a song that's got the word anthracite.
Exactly, right? You gotta respect the effort.
Yeah. Sean Ramaswaram, of course, host of Sideshow, Studio 360 podcast about art, about Sean, about stuff you don't see in museums. Take care, Sean.
All right, thanks, Chad.
If the promised rapprochement between the U.S. and Cuba really comes to pass, it will end an episode in a long, complicated engagement between the United States and the Caribbean nations. The islands of the Caribbean well preceded the United States as bustling European settlements and were prosperous long before the USA became a dominant economic superpower in the 20th century. But when Fidel Castro came to power in 1959, Cuba was flexing a muscle that has deep resonance in this hemisphere.
There is a limit to what the United States and self-respect can endure. That limit has now been reached. Our friendship for the Cuban people is not affected. It is my hope and my conviction that in the not-too-distant future, it will be possible for the historic friendship between us once again to find reflection in normal relations of every sort.
President Dwight Eisenhower speaking about the Castro Revolution in Cuba back in 1961. It is, in fact, normal for Cuba and the U.S. to be rivals, normal for there to be conflict and competition between the U.S. and the rest of the Caribbean nations. What is changing now in Washington and Havana goes way beyond the Cold War. Down through history, the Caribbean has been the social laboratory of the diversity of the New World, while the United States has brutally fought that diversity within its own borders. Historian Carrie Gibson is the author of Empire's Crossroads, A History of the Caribbean from Columbus to the Present Day. She says the Cuba story is one piece of a vast saga of culture and language.
The Caribbean is many things in its many worlds, and in some ways, when I was writing this book, I wasn't even sure if I should write about the Caribbean as a unit.
Right.
Are these places too unique? And I thought, what brings them together, what makes them a place, is this shared history that they have. And it's one that starts with Columbus, and it's one that's shared through today.
The amazing thing about the narrative here is that the politics of the Caribbean are so much more progressive than anything going on in North America. I mean, it's really a land of turmoil and advanced ideas and a much stronger sense of democracy and equality than even existed in the United States.
Certainly, I think that comes out of this very complicated brew of greed, looking for gold, then the sugar plantations. And then as you get into the 20th century, absolutely the countries and the nations that come out of the colonial system become, you know, very much at the forefront of ideas about democracy. You know, trade unionism is very strong, of freedom. What freedom means is, you know, an incredibly important thing in the Caribbean, and it has a very different tenor to the way we talk about freedom in the Founding Fathers here. I think, you know, when you talk about freedom and abolition in somewhere like Jamaica, it's a related conversation, but it's also a very different one.
A very different one. And who are the leaders of the abolitionist movement in a place like Jamaica, in a place like Haiti? And Haiti is really the advanced sort of leader of human rights in the Caribbean.
No, absolutely. And within Haiti, it was very interesting, too, because there are many cracks and divisions, because the revolution was a long struggle, and it was very multifaceted. So on one hand, you had slaves who rose up. On the other hand, you had free people of color getting involved, too. You had it across very many levels of society. And in the end, I think that's what helped make it so successful, is that it cut across certain things, free and slave, light skin, dark skin. You know, the leadership, for instance, Toussaint Louverture, the most famous, he was a former slave.
Did the rise of the United States and the industrial might of the United States erase the history of the Caribbean? Did it displace the sense of the Caribbean's leadership in dealing with being the sort of the leader of the New World? So much in 20th century history of the United States versus the Caribbean is all about a kind of neocolonialism and the revolution in Nicaragua, the banana republics, all of that sort of thing.
you know, the U.S. has had a heavy hand, certainly during the Cold War, in dealing with the Caribbean. And culturally, I think it's been hard to avoid America's influence. But what I think has come out of this is that America doesn't see its relationship with its own history to the Caribbean's history and to the Caribbean struggle. And I feel like there's this disconnect between the U.S. thinking, oh, those are some islands, where people in the Caribbean and across the islands, they you know, it's very diasporic, there's lots of family members here, and they see a much more fluid, you know, relationship.
How did the jet age change the relationship between the people of North America and the people of the Caribbean? You suddenly had places that were much more accessible than had ever been in the past.
There became a realization on one hand that tourism was a way to raise money, and pressure from international organizations on the other, like the IMF, to develop that economy at the expense of more traditional ones like fishing or agriculture. All is kind of developing as the jet age makes travel cheaper. And in the 40s and 50s, you know, the Caribbean was kind of an exotic hideaway for the wealthy, too.
Mm-hmm. And the wealthy's money.
Yes. You know, these resorts were built. They were all inclusive. And all of a sudden, people from here and from Britain and other parts of Europe could come to the Caribbean and kind of enjoy that, what they thought was kind of the five-star lifestyle. And I think that kind of still persists to this day. Mm-hmm. But it made it easier to come and go. But it also made it easier to immigrate and leave, too.
If you include Mexico and, you know, the rise of South America as part of the sort of momentum of the Spanish-speaking people in this hemisphere, the 21st century is really going to be defined by the Spanish-speaking rise in the Caribbean and elsewhere. And really, we're seeing a decline in the English-speaking power and politics in North America. And so your doctorate is sort of well-timed, it would seem.
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, the Spanish-speaking people of the whole hemisphere, you know, the 21st century is going to be a very busy one, I think, for them in the U.S. And also what's interesting is there's such an enormous diversity. People from the Caribbean, you know, have long been in New York, Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, but now you're seeing people move elsewhere. You know, I write about creolization in the book, and it would be nice if the U.S. kind of saw itself as a bit more of a creolized place. Like, people come from all these places, we come together, we melt, we, you know. I mean, I think New Orleans is probably the one place that represents that in the U.S., you know, this kind of merging of different things. And seeing the Caribbean as part of that story and the contribution from people from Jamaica or from Cuba or and what that means to the bigger picture of U.S. history and U.S. contemporary culture as well. That we accept that people's backgrounds can be complicated and diverse and bring many influences.
So in your exploration of the Caribbean, do you have a preference for baseball or cricket?
Oh, because I grew up in the U.S., I'm going to have to say baseball. But I am quite fond of cricket.
And they're very popular in both.
There's a lot of love there for bat and ball sports.
A lot of love in this book for the Caribbean empires. Crossroads, the history of the Caribbean from the Columbus to the present day. Kerry Gibson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the show, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Next week, ahead of Christmas, we're talking about how families and parents navigate the holiday if they don't celebrate it. Do you let your kids have a tree, exchange presents? What are the rules in your house if you are not Christian? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.